In this episode, I'm going to interview Jared Fernandez, a shareholder advocate with Green Century Mutual Funds. This is the Impact Financial Planners Podcast with Bill Holiday, making sustainable, responsible impact investing easy for socially conscious investors who want to make a positive change through their investments. Brought to you by AIO Financial, a fee-only fiduciary financial planning firm specializing in SRI. At AIOfinancial.com. Thank you for joining me on this episode. I'm glad to have this interview with Jared Fernandez of Green Century. He's spent his professional life working to better the national food system. Conventional agriculture is carbon intensive, and national food policy prioritizes feeding cattle over communities. He has worked to promote regional food systems that simultaneously build soil, economies, and communities. Green Century is a mutual fund asset manager, mutual fund company. They combine fossil fuel-free sustainable investing with shareholder advocacy, and they support environmental nonprofits. All right, let's go to the interview. All right, Jared, thank you very much for joining me.
Sure, thank you for having me, Bill. Glad to be here today.
Could you just start by describing what Green Century offers?
Sure, certainly. So Green Century is an environmentally responsible mutual fund company based here in Boston. We seek to invest in environmental leaders and innovators, including companies involved with renewable energy, water efficiency, healthy food companies, as well as just companies that are really leading their industry within environmental, social, and governance performance. There's a large and growing body of evidence which really demonstrates that choosing investments by incorporating ESG performance may ultimately reduce risk for investors and offer financial advantages. And we believe that companies that are actively working to protect the environment and reduce their footprint may be more profitable in the long run by avoiding risks and by being prepared for changing regulation and growing through competitive advantages. So using this investment strategy, Green Century offers three mutual funds, our Balanced Fund, which is our flagship fund, the Green Century Equity Fund, and the Green Century International Index Fund. The International Index Fund is a relatively newer fund that was started in 2016, but has the distinction of being the very first responsible and diversified fossil fuel-free international index fund in the country.
Oh, that's great. And just to clarify those three, international, it's mostly developed international large companies?
Precisely, yep. So our international index fund invests in companies in 22 of the 23 developed economies around the globe, the one omission obviously being the United States. So yes, it is a fund that is specifically targeting developed economies.
And the U.S. equity would be large U.S. generally?
Yep, exactly. It's predominantly all large cap companies, 100% U.S. based. The balanced fund that we have as well. This is a mix of both equity as well as fixed income bonds. Historically, that fund has been at about 70% stock and 30% bonds. It's notable our bond exposure in that about half of the bonds within the Green Century Balanced Fund are actually green bonds that support environmental remediation projects around the globe. And that fund is predominantly U.S. There is a little bit of international exposure within that fund.
Great. And how big is shareholder advocacy for Green Century? How big of a component is that?
Yeah, I mean, we like to think of shareholder advocacy as being really one of the three main prongs within our firm's approach that enables our investors to make an impact. To a certain extent, you could say it's a third of what we do here. The three prongs that we have, one is the investment strategy and the fact that we are actively seeking solutions-oriented companies through our investments to help enable our investors make an impact. Another prong is our unique nonprofit ownership. Some may not know that Green Century Capital Management was actually founded by a consortium of environmental nonprofits back in 1991, and we maintain that ownership to this day. And what that really means is that every dollar that Green Century Capital Management earns managing the Green Century funds actually belongs back to those nonprofits and supports the environmental and social advocacy work that they do. And so in terms of shareholder advocacy, that would be the third prong of our impact approach. We currently have two full-time staff members working on shareholder advocacy at Green Century, myself and my colleague, Jesse Waxman.
That's great. And what are the areas you're addressing with shareholder advocacy?
Yeah, certainly. So, you know, we work on a number of critical issue areas, such as preserving tropical forests, promoting renewable energy, protecting pollinators in our food supply, keeping antibiotics effective within the public health sphere, pollution, and conserving ocean health. But we also work on a number of really niche topics that also have a tremendous impact on our environment, such as reducing food waste within corporations and promoting plant-based protein.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. So it's, I mean, environmental, but a big focus sounds like, well, climate change, I imagine, is a big one, and agriculture sounds like a big.
Exactly. Yeah, we try to sort of siphon all the issue areas that we work on sort of in a climate change bucket as well as a sustainable agriculture bucket. And, you know, for those who, you know, are following these issues really closely in the issue of climate change, sustainable agriculture really poses a tremendous opportunity to significantly reduce the global carbon footprint and to mitigate some of the worst effects of climate change. So when working on things like preserving tropical forests, which is one of the preeminent drivers of global climate change, you know, we feel like we're both promoting sustainable agriculture and addressing climate change at the same time.
Great. Yeah, that makes sense. It's a broader issue. I mean, the environment touches many issues. How do you engage with companies? Proxy voting, shareholder resolutions, or what's your main strategy?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, proxy voting is sort of the baseline of what firms can do with regards to shareholder advocacy. And we certainly do vote our proxies. And we, you know, do outline very clearly our proxy voting guidelines for the firm. Publicly available on our websites that everybody is able to see, you know, what sort of proposals brought before companies we will support and which sort of proposals we would not support. But Green Century definitely seeks to take our shareholder advocacy many, many, many steps further. And so, you know, we leverage the fact that we hold these publicly traded companies to really engage with corporate sustainability teams and C-suite executives directly. We approach companies within our portfolios detailing the potential environmental risk that they may be facing within their operations and supply chains. And we do a lot of work on our end to really try to lay out the business case for why these companies should be moving to address these issues. I would say that really every engagement that we have with companies is different. Some are extremely positive and we're able to really have very productive conversations about these issues. Sometimes we're actually bringing new issues to a company's sustainability team that they have not previously considered and really giving them a different point of view. For some engagements that are not as productive and for corporations that are not willing to really see eye to eye with us on some of these issues, we do utilize the shareholder proposal process to be able to bring these issues that we believe are material, not only to the company, but to the greater public good before all shareholders for them to voice their concern.
What would be a good way for investors to evaluate your engagement?
I think it's a couple of things. I think one would be looking at really the size and scope of the company that's being engaged, but also the size and scope of the issue that's being discussed with the company relative to their operations. So, you know, when we're talking to some of the largest agricultural grain traders around the globe about tropical forest protection and eliminating deforestation within their supply chain, this is obviously one of the largest components of what they do. It's sourcing agricultural products that historically have been tied and to this day are still tied to massive rates of deforestation. So, but past that, It's also looking at the specifics of what we are talking to companies about and what we may potentially be getting agreements on, whether that be working with companies to ensure that their definition of deforestation includes not only illegal deforestation within the companies that they operate, but also legal deforestation. Past the size and scope of the company, the materiality to the company, and the specifics of any sort of engagement, I think it's also looking at some of the more unique issue areas that a lot of firms might not be engaging on, such as food waste or plant-based protein, where, you know, food waste, 40% of the food produced in America is wasted and not ultimately consumed by people. And poses a huge, huge problem for climate change, as about 20% of methane emissions in the United States come from wasted food decomposing in landfills. And methane is a much stronger greenhouse gas than carbon. So one of the really interesting things that I've learned in doing this work is that food waste is such an emerging issue that companies just aren't even beginning to track it. So a lot of the conversations that we have with companies is starting to get those food waste audits in place, because we fundamentally believe that you cannot manage what you don't measure. And so getting companies to begin to measure this problem, understand how big of an issue it is for them, and to be able to translate that. Oftentimes when we are securing agreements with companies, we ask them to really put it in tangible terms for us so that we are able to understand the impact, whether it be, you know, greenhouse gas emissions that are avoided through the, that we can understand it, but then also convey that to our investors to get a sense of the size, scope, and impact of the advocacy that we're doing.
So an example of promoting plant-based protein or reducing food waste, who would be a company and how would you engage them?
So for plant-based protein, I would cite Tyson Foods, which we engaged with a few years ago. I'll make the distinction that they're not held in the Green Century funds. This was an engagement that we did outside of the holdings within the funds that our investors invest in. And we engaged with them on basically asking them to issue a report to shareholders on the risks that their business faced with the growing demand for plant-based protein in the consumer market. We have seen over the past 5 years that the demand for plant-based protein has been growing much faster than the sales of conventional meat. Plant-based foods are just more eco-friendly than their animal-based counterparts, as they're much more efficient to produce. They require less land, less water, less fuel, and other resources to grow. We brought this to Tyson, who had no exposure to any sort of plant-based protein within their portfolio, and asked them to basically tell investors what they were doing to mitigate that risk. We filed a shareholder proposal with them, and soon afterwards, the company actually announced that it had taken a 5% stake in Beyond Meat, which is one of the leading plant-based protein producers in the country, and really demonstrated to us that they were beginning to recognize that, yes, they are a protein company. They don't necessarily have to be sole company. And the hope is that their investments in these plant-based spaces grow at a much faster rate than their traditional meat production, so that that will facilitate further investment. And we've actually already seen that. Tyson started a $150 million venture capital fund a few years ago, looking specifically at small plant-based protein startups to invest in. And they actually have a new line of ready-to-eat plant-based meals that are going to be featured in grocery stores very soon, called Green Street. So they have been rapidly expanding their exposure to plant-based options. And I think it's because they see that that's where consumers are moving.
Sure, it'll help their bottom line as well.
Precisely.
I like that you engage outside of companies that you own in the portfolio, because I could see that being a difficult situation where you want to make an impact, but you're screening a lot of those harmful companies out of the portfolio to begin with.
Exactly. I mean, you know, we understand at Green Century that even companies that lead in sustainability will still have room for improvement. And so we work with dozens of companies every single year across most sectors of the economy to adopt stronger environmental practices and policies throughout their supply chains. But that being said, every once in a while, we will seek an engagement, again, outside of our funds for something really key that we think is a significant business risk risk that a company should be addressing.
That makes sense. When investors are looking at different mutual fund companies, what is a gauge they can look at to determine which companies are actually engaging and making a difference with their advocacy? You can get some ETF that says they're ESG SRI, and they do no engagement. They don't even vote proxies. And what else would you recommend people look at to determine that engagement?
Sure, certainly. So I would look to see what sort of associations or any sort of broader collaborations that fund may be a part of. So for example, we work with a number of other investors that operate in the shareholder advocacy space through both a network of investors with Ceres, which is a nonprofit based here in Boston that promotes business, environmentally focused business solutions, as well as a number of other investors through a group called ICCR, which is the Interfaith Coalition for Corporate Responsibility. So I think that looking at sort of broader networks that an investor is engaged with is really critical, but also looking at sort of other mechanisms, like the fact that we sit on two Principles for Responsible Investment, PRI advisory boards. We're really deeply entrenched in this sort of work. And so, to answer your question at evaluating other firms and the scope of their advocacy work, I really think, yes, it's doing a little bit of research and voting your proxies is great, but going a step further to actually not only physically engage one-on-one with companies, the filing of shareholder resolutions, I think, does demonstrate that an investor is willing to go that extra step because, and to be completely frank, not every corporation in America is willing to discuss tangible business risks with investors, every single investor that reaches out to them. So I do think that taking that shareholder proposal approach is extremely important, but then seeing how the firm really operates in the broader sphere of shareholder advocacy, looking at co-filings that they may have with other firms, I think really demonstrates a firm commitment to the idea of shareholder advocacy. And I think that's a pretty strong barometer by which to judge how strongly a firm is entrenched in this work.
Sure. And about how many shareholder resolutions was Green Century a part of last year or 2018?
Yeah, sure. So in 2018, having to think about this off the top of my head, I think that we probably filed somewhere close to 10 shareholder resolutions, the majority of which, we were able to withdraw.
That's great.
To an agreement with a company. The way the shareholder resolution process works is you file a resolution and then you have a certain amount of time to really work with the company behind the scenes to try to find a mutually acceptable solution, whether that be the company adopting a policy that reflects what you're asking for in the shareholder proposal, if the proposal is simply asking for greater disclosure around an issue to be able to enable investors to make more informed decisions and analyses of a company's exposure to risk. A lot of companies might be open to that. We did only go to a few annual meetings last year, which is, if you're not able to come to that mutually accepted agreement with a company, the proposal then goes forward to be featured on the company's proxy statement, at which all shareholders are able to vote on their support for or against the proposal. And the lead investor is expected to then present the proposal at the company's annual meeting. So this past year, we went to two annual meetings at both General Mills as well as Darden Restaurants, one of the largest casual sit-down restaurant chains in the country, holding companies for casual restaurant chains. But our aim in filing a resolution is the best outcome for everybody is a withdrawal, because ultimately companies don't really want us on their proxy and have these potential risks being exposed to all of their shareholders. And ultimately, we just want to see the companies make positive progress towards addressing some of these environmental risks.
And so you're thinking that agriculture is one of the biggest impacts to the environment right now?
Yeah, it's tremendous. Everything from the world's insatiable appetite for meat and the impact that beef production has on the environment and the release of methane, as well as all of the inputs that go into our industrial monoculture agricultural system, pesticides, insecticides, fertilizers, these all are extremely input heavy, and many of which are fossil fuel based. So, taking an approach towards sustainable agriculture not only can have significant benefits for climate impact, but also can have significant benefits for regarding things like nutrient runoff, water pollution, worker and community health around farms. It's all intertwined.
Yeah, and I could see even just financially, it would make sense investing in companies that are forward thinking or thinking about the consequences, impacts they're having.
Yeah, precisely. And not just from a cost of inputs point of view, but also from a potential regulatory point of view.
Yeah,
I think about our work on toxic pesticides like neonicotinoids and glyphosate. The European Union earlier this year announced a permanent ban on neonicotinoids within all European Union countries because of the well-established link between the use of these pesticides and the decline in wild pollinators. And we've seen some bills introduced in states around the United States that seek to limit the use of neonicotinoids in certain agricultural practices. If the United States were ever to adopt any sort of legislation that mirrored that of the European Union, companies that are currently working to minimize their use of neonicotinoids within their supply chains are going to be able to adapt to that regulation, if they have not already adapted, are going to be able to adapt much more nimbly and perhaps not face the same sort of price shocks or gaps in supply that some of the current laggards might.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. How do you feel shareholder advocacy is making an impact?
Certainly, yeah. I think that that's really the approach that we take, is that in the absence of a strong governmental push to address a lot of these latent problems within our agricultural world or within our energy world, businesses really need to step up to address a lot of these problems. And I think one of the issue areas that we work on that really underscores the power that shareholder advocacy can have in terms of making substantial and tangible change is within the use of antibiotics in animal agriculture. Mm. I'll preface this by saying that a lot of people don't know that about 70% of the medically important antibiotics produced and they're sold in the United States, and medically important just meaning antibiotics that we use every day for human health and preserving our health, 70% are actually sold for use in animal agriculture.
Mm.
And
I didn't know that.
It's insane. And what this is ultimately driving is the development of antimicrobial resistant bacteria, which is a tremendous threat to public health and can effectively render these antibiotics that we've been relying on for decades to keep us safe, to save us from infection. It can render them effectively useless. The Centers for Disease Control estimates that 23,000 Americans die every year from antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and the number, according to the World Health Organization, is expected to grow to potentially be millions and millions by 2050 around the globe.
Hmm.
So shareholders have been working on this issue for a few years now, pressuring some of America's largest fast food chains to actually eliminate the practice of providing routine antibiotics to farm animals. We've seen tremendous movement in the poultry industry, especially around companies like Starbucks. McDonald's has made some huge steps with regards to this in their poultry industry, and actually just recently they became the first fast food chain, major fast food chain, to announce a policy that would address their beef supply chain as well. We have not seen as much movement on beef, but today about 50%, nearly 50% of the chicken raised in the United States is now raised without the routine use of medically important antibiotics, which is a tremendous step forward from where we were just 4 or 5 years ago.
But why is there so much antibiotics being used on animals that people are consuming? Is it because there's just so many animals we're consuming, or is it they're just getting sick a lot?
It is a product of the industrial animal agriculture system that we are now a part of. Ultimately, when talking to companies about eliminating this practice from their supply chains, what it ultimately means is that their suppliers have to improve animal welfare standards on the farm. These antibiotics are needed because animals are put in confined cages where they're not able to move and are lying on their side and develop sores that become infected, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of it has to do with the living conditions, the tight living conditions on these farms that we have accepted as a society over the past few years for the prospect of the cheapest meat protein that we can possibly produce. Ultimately, what we're seeing is that has significant repercussions for human health in a way that we maybe did not predict 20 years ago.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I guess just any other examples you want to share of work that you're doing?
Yeah, certainly. So, I can talk a little bit about our deforestation work. So, in our efforts to curb global climate change, prevent loss of habitat for endangered species, and to mitigate the potential financial risks for investors associated with companies being linked to deforestation in their supply chains, we engage with dozens of companies every single year on this specific topic. Deforestation alone accounts for more than 10% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And as alluded to, it contributes to endangered species, habitat destruction, human rights violations, water cycle disruptions. And agriculture really is the leading driver of deforestation around the globe. It accounts for about 70% of tropical forest deforestation, a lot of which is used to produce soy, which feeds those cows that we were just talking about, which are it's all linked to a certain extent. So to help curb climate change and to mitigate risk for investors, we've been working to reduce deforestation caused by the production of palm oil, soy, cattle, timber, and rubber across the globe in Asia, Latin America, and Africa. And so we've had a lot of successes in this over the past 5 years. I think one of the ones that really we're most proud of are our efforts to secure a zero deforestation commitment from Wilmar International. They are the world's largest palm oil trader. The securement that we were able to, the agreement that we were able to secure from them a few years ago, we have been able to calculate will avoid 1.5 gigatons of carbon pollution between 2015 and 2020.
Oh, that's great. So they're just going to get their palm oil from another source or not use or use a substitute?
Actively working with the growers that they source from to ensure that sustainable non-deforested practices are utilized. And to a certain extent, if there are some plantations or growers that are not in compliance, then there may be the need to move on and find different suppliers as well.
No, that's great. I guess thank you very much, Jared, for your time and explaining these issues. Without an administration pushing for these, it's important to get companies engaged. How can people find out more about Green Century?
Certainly. So I welcome everybody to visit our website. It's www.greencentury.com. There we, detail most things that I talked about earlier on this podcast, including our investment strategy, our unique nonprofit ownership, as well as the advocacy work that we do. I welcome everybody to visit our site. Whenever we get any sort of wins on the shareholder advocacy side, we make sure to put a little press release on our website, maybe write a blog about it as well. And I also highly encourage people to sign up for our e-news as well to receive bi-monthly updates from us via email. And again, we like to just share some of the notable wins and exciting things that we have going on here at Green Century.
That's great. I'll put a link to the e-news and to the website and in the show notes.
Great.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you so much, Bill. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Have a great day.
As you can tell, Green Century is very engaged. You're very active with shareholder engagement, which is a key component to sustainable, responsible impact investing, because engagement is actually what moves companies in a positive direction. Just buying and selling or holding and not holding certain companies does not move companies. Well, thank you very much for listening to the Impact Financial Planners podcast. This has been brought to you by AIO Financial. If you need help with any part of your finances, please contact AIO Financial for a free meeting, aiofinancial.com. As always, I appreciate your feedback. Please reach out. Anything you have to say is appreciated, good, bad, suggestions, comments. You can comment here wherever you're finding this, or shoot me an email, call, whatever. Okay. And if you do like these podcasts, please leave a brief review and rating on iTunes, subscribe to our YouTube channel. All that helps make these more easily found by other people. Okay. Take care. Bye.